Top 100 Project is sponsored by Sparkplug Coffee. Every coffee lover knows that the key to the best coffee is fresh roasted beans. Most coffee you buy in the grocery store or your local coffee shop was roasted months before it got to you. Sparkplug Coffee is roasted to order in Toronto and delivered right to your door anywhere in Canada while the coffee is fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug offers plenty of variety and grinds to suit any taste. Their scientific roast process ensures consistency so that each blend maintains its flavor profile. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in by going to sparkplug.coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Welcome to the podcast, you brainwashed film fans, and thanks for checking out the Top 100 Project. We're here to chat about the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 list of 100 greatest American movies. To avoid thorough spoilers, you should stop listening right now, but please come back later. I am Ryan Ellis with my very own Queen of Diamonds, my wife Bev, who is the kindest, warmest, bravest, most wonderful human being I've ever known in my life.
Perhaps our listeners would like to pass the time by playing a little solitaire.
Start downloading every podcast we've ever done over and over and over again.
Tell your friends to listen to the Top 100 Project.
Every friend you've ever had. And go jump in a lake. All right, the coming attractions trivia for The Manchurian Candidate. Obviously, this week's film. This is one of eight AFI movies that were remade theatrically using the exact same name. Name the other seven.
Okay, I'm sure I can get a few of these. Stagecoach.
That's correct.
Psycho.
Two.
Wuthering Heights.
That's three.
King Kong.
Four.
The Jazz Singer.
Cinco.
I'm out.
All right, there's two more. I will name them in order of when they first appeared on the project. The Jazz Singer. Frankenstein. That's been done several times now.
Oh my God, of course.
I guess particularly the Branagh De Niro version in 94. You said King Kong. Mutiny on the Bounty.
Oh my God, of course.
Which Brando, of course, did in 60.
I missed easy ones.
Brando did in 62. And then Stagecoach, you said. Wuthering Heights, you said. And Psycho, you said. Also, Wizard of Oz, Maltese Falcon, Ben-Hur, and Lord of the Rings are remakes.
Yeah,
that wasn't a question, but have to include those too.
I forget that Lord of the Rings is a remake.
And the reason I said in the previous week about it being the exact name is because you could go in the whole thing about Mutiny on the Bounty was just called The Bounty with Mel Gibson and Anthony Hopkins and all these little wrinkles that went into this stuff.
Yeah, there's probably versions of Frankenstein as well that aren't titled the same thing. And Wizard of Oz, of course, you have The Wiz.
Mm-hmm. But there you go. So eight in total remakes. Okay, but back to this week's film. And we have just passed the halfway point because this is the Top 100 Project's 62nd movie.
Oh, what do you know?
And of course, there are 123 in total that we'll review.
Yeah.
And it is The Manchurian Candidate, which was 67th on the AFI's 1998 Top 100 between one of my favorites, Network, and An American in Paris. Then it inexplicably fell all the way off the 2007 Top 100, but was among the 400 nominees at least. Manchurian Candidate was released on October 24th, 1962. While not the remarkable hit that we've been seeing lately, it wasn't a dud either. Now, Bev's going to tell you about this film with a skinny.
Frank Sinatra is Korean War veteran Major Bennett Marco, the leader of an American platoon captured and brainwashed by communists. Lawrence Harvey plays Raymond Shaw, the unlikable sergeant who's considered a glorious hero in the brainwashed opinions of his fellow soldiers. Survivors of the platoon head home, and that's when the twists begin.
That is truly barely explaining the movie at all.
No, I know, that's like...
One of the great things about this film,
there's so much more.
But in a nutshell, journalists commit step patricide, matricide, then suicide in a claimed sporting venue. All right, then, why don't you tell the listeners what you said to me when it was first over about how you like this movie, how much you like this movie.
I don't remember what I said.
That you thought it should be in the top 10.
Yeah, if I was composing my own top 100, this would be in the top 10. And I'm not talking about my personal favorites, but films that I honestly think are some of the best films ever made. I really think this would be in my top 10. I just love this movie so much. I think it's a masterpiece.
That's a strong, strong review.
I mean, you agree with me, right? Maybe not top 10.
Not top 10.
But you agree you're absolutely outraged, as I am.
I try not to editorialize in the part where I describe the release date and where it ranked on the list and all that stuff that I always do at the top of the podcast. I try to just make that straight facts. But I did include the word inexplicably.
I think that the voters, they really do resist things that are complicated and dark.
Could be.
There's definitely a preference for things that are optimistic and warmer and friendlier, or if they're dark, they have this really safe message. You know, you could say Schindler's List is dark, but the Holocaust is bad. Oh my God, brave of you.
In 2 weeks, we covered To Kill a Mockingbird,
right?
Which has an uplifting ending.
It's an uplifting ending, even though he gets Oh gosh, spoiler alert. it's not really an uplift.
The very ending, I mean, there's some uplift to it.
There's some uplift to it.
And there's hope.
And there's hope. And the whole point is that they're basically saying racism is bad. People should be treated fairly in the court. That's a very safe place to go.
Dr. Strangelove we cover after To Kill a Mockingbird. And by the way, that's 3 out of 4 movies we're going to cover that are black and white. Even though the 60s are known for their huge blockbuster epic Technicolor widescreen. Mm-hmm. We've covered a few already. Spartacus, West Side Story last week. We get My Fair Lady and Sound of Music and Dr. Zhivago right in a row. But we do have 3 out of 4 that are very different and very, I would say, cynical. But Strangelove has hope too, because it's all about how, my viewer, I can walk! And they're all going to go into the underground tunnels. Probably not live. The mine shafts, right. Probably not survive, actually, but they're going to be fornicating with the many women down there and the dozens of men.
10 women for each man.
Exactly. So even that movie has hope, despite the nuclear holocaust at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
But all right, let's bring it back down to something a little more non-world-destroying, and that is The Manchurian Candidate. What are your overall thoughts?
Well, like I said, I'm outraged that it was removed from the list. Since maybe Double Indemnity, I don't think we've seen as effective a thriller, and I'm including all the Hitchcock films.
Hmm.
It's super stylish and modern, and it feels way, way ahead of its time, even though the subject matter is eerily appropriate. I'm sure we'll talk about its release date. I remember loving this film when I first saw it years ago, but now watching it in context with all the other great films from the same era, it is leaps and bounds above everything else that we're watching, and it probably paved the way for one of our favorite films, Dr. Strangelove. You can't give Dr. Strangelove credit for really paving the way for this kind of darkness and this kind of subject matter. Do I think it did it better? I don't even know. I like Dr. Strangelove more. I prefer that movie, but I think that Manchurian Candidate is a better film.
That's a funny comparison, because Dr. Strangelove's release date was moved from late 1963 because Kennedy had been shot and killed.
Yeah.
But Manchurian Candidate came out in October 62. And that is coming right on the heels of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And basically a year before JFK was murdered.
Yeah.
About 13 months before, by a sniper shot.
Yeah.
Somebody shooting with a high-powered gun from an elevated position.
Yeah.
Let's not get into Oswald and all that stuff. Actually, one thing about Oswald, we will get into it by saying this. Was Lee Harvey Oswald brainwashed by communists?
This film was blamed for giving people the impression that brainwashing was actually this effective. It's not. This movie, and it received criticism for this in the past, and I think even still now, for the ridiculousness of the premise that in 3 days you could brainwash. First of all, you could brainwash anybody this completely. You can't. But that even in 3 days you could brainwash someone to this extent.
Make him go against his nature that he wouldn't want to kill anyone, really, but especially his own platoon mates. Yeah. He may not like them very much. They don't like him, but he wouldn't want to murder them.
People's brains are...
And then someone
are,
he's married to, he clearly loves her.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. People's brains are not like computers that you can reprogram, that you can insert a virus in and make them do whatever they want. That's not how the brain works. And they knew that in the 60s, and they know that now. But that hasn't stopped people from kind of believing the concepts presented in this
Well, it is a sci-fi premise in a way. Mm-hmm. But then the character who plays the brainwasher, his real name is Kenneth Dickerson. He's from New Jersey. He's the guy that looks like he's Asian, Chinese, I suppose. It's supposed to be Manchurian, refers, of course, to Manchuria, which is a north part of China, right near the Russian border. But Kenneth Dickerson went by the name Kai D. If you look on the IMDb, you'll see how it's spelled. But he's the one that says something like, he laughs it off. And he's constantly laughing. He's very cynical. He's like a Bond villain. He's like, take things less seriously than you do. You guys want to change the entire world and maybe bring things to an end for all of us. But laugh it off. But he's the one that snarks at the idea that you can't change somebody's opinion, you can't make him murder somebody. Then, of course, he goes on to show that Shaw will strangle one guy who has no issue with, and the guy won't even fight back.
Yeah.
And then the more effective moment, actually, in those scenes, those great brainwashing flashback scenes, is when he blows the young kid's head off.
It's so violent. Mm-hmm. It's like really quite visceral, and they show blood. They may not show it coming out of his head, but they show it splattering.
A geyser that
on the
splatters on
him. Yeah.
Of the political leaders of the communist side of things. Interesting.
Yeah, it's, and even his chair falling back, it's an incredibly viscerally violent death.
And none of the other soldiers, of course, they wouldn't because they've been brainwashed. And let's go with the notion that this can happen because the movie says
it can. You just have to accept the reality the same way we believe that like Oz exists. It's a suspension of disbelief, but we'll go with it. Yeah.
But none of them react even when their buddy's been killed. It's not even a matter of they didn't stop Raymond or they just innocently watch him do this, but they don't react even when that's happened because that's what they've been trained to do, and it's a pretty fascinating idea. Mm-hmm. And Shaw may be a horrible person. None of them actually like him, despite the fact they say he's the kindest, bravest, most warm, whatever that thing is. I've already forgotten it. I need to play some solitaire to remember that line.
Yeah.
Now, there's one thing, by the way, too, a movie that's about such horribly painful stuff also has a lot of humor.
Yeah.
I mentioned the jumping in the lake scene, and I love the way that plays out. They pick a phrase that somebody could say in reality.
Yeah,
it feels you to play believable. A little game of solitaire. Then, of course, when he sees the Queen of Diamonds, next thing he hears is going to be something he does. Go jump in a lake. And he actually does do it.
And many parts of the Islands are pretty funny. Like, Edge of Lansbury, his mother, his stepfather, they have lots of great laughs. The Heinz 57 mm-hmm. joke.
That's one of my favorite moments of the whole movie, for sure.
There's 57 comments in the defense.
Give me a number I can stick with. And then, of course, the ketchup bottle and that great cut. This movie's got some fantastic edits in it. That's one of my favorite cuts.
Maybe that's
in any
what part of the reason I love it so much. It is a really well-edited film. Like,
there are exactly 57 communists in the State Department. I love how when he said it earlier, and Sinatra, I forgot Sinatra, I does have a very brief scene with those two, Angela Lansbury and James Gregory, in that scene when he is representing a senator very briefly. He doesn't get to do it for very long.
Yeah,
he's his PR
right.
guy.
Because
he goes in, and how many are there? How many communists? And the guy changes the number. I think it's three times. He says it
in
when he's out in front of everybody.
Press
and he says it, I think, twice in the cloakroom. Yeah. So three different numbers in the span of a minute and a half.
The Senate's making fun of me, dear. Can I just pick a number and stick with it?
We didn't see a lot of James Gregory in the scope of movies, certainly not major movies, as it went on. He did guest spots on TV for a lot, and he was later on Barney Miller, but he's very funny in this movie. He's a comical fool. Johnny Iceland is a completely comical idiot. A lot of senators are probably in about his league.
I think I called him Rick Perry at some point, because he was just such an obvious buffoon, and he was so transparently dumb. And yet, he actually could have realistically become
He isn't
president.
That different. If you've ever seen any clips of the actual McCarthy, and that's clearly who he's supposed to emulate, McCarthy seemed phony. You don't like Goodnight, Good Luck. I love that movie. They show the actual guy. And apparently the studio questioned Clooney and said, that guy's not believable. And Clooney said, those are clips of the actual dude saying these lines.
Yeah. Was he a drunk? Or
I don't know if he was a drunk. I don't remember that. I've never done my McCarthy research.
Yeah.
But of course, Iceland is, clearly. He's drinking all the time.
You know, we talked in our Spartacus podcast about how Kirk Douglas had taken credit for ending the blacklist.
He sure did.
They tore down those walls and there were tanks behind it. The amount of anger and gusto in this, HUAC had no control and people were mad. It just feels like this powder keg of pent-up anger that was released in this film. It's almost overkill. It would be like the one criticism I would give this film would be how thick they lay it on the McCarthyism thing. They even call it Islandism.
Mm-hmm.
Islandism, like the witch hunting of communists.
In the State Department, yeah.
Yeah.
People actually believe that this was real in the 60s, 50s before that, that there really were people working in the actual government who would have had some influence, maybe even a lot of influence, who were communists who were out to destroy America. But when you get into the Hollywood part of it, they have influence to a point, but they're not politicians. So it's funny how you get a movie that's about politics, and not many movies on our list do that. Here's something that really does truly matter. They can affect change.
Yeah.
Versus Hollywood, where you're writing a fictional story.
If you believe that a Hollywood director has more influence over the thoughts and minds of Americans than policymakers and lawmakers and the Senate,
especially
the House,
a senator,
then that just speaks to the effectiveness of propaganda to make you believe that, because that's absolutely false.
Yeah. Well, we've talked so much about politics. Don't forget, this is also just flat out the height of the Cold War. And this movie is what Nixon and McCarthy were so worried about, their worst nightmare. Nixon was a big red hunter, too. And people don't always want to acknowledge that. Nixon was an effective politician for all of his crimes later on. He really became famous for being somebody that went after communists, Alger Hiss and some other people. McCarthy was the buffoon. Nixon was at least credible. And he was a vice president for 8 years, so he was very credible. But their biggest concern would have been exactly what's happening in this movie. They're taking away our freedom. And they're using our own guys. That is one of the lowest blows. And I mean that in a good way about this movie. That they use their own best, if Raymond is one of their best. He isn't the hero he's supposed to be. But they use him to kill their own people.
Yeah, to take part in their schemes unwillingly. Even though, if you think about it, they seem to have a lot of agents who are perfectly dedicated to the cause. It's a wonder that if they can get somebody into the presidency, why couldn't they get someone else to just be the assassin? Like, why would they even have to brainwash somebody to perform these duties when they could just get one of their loyal servants to do it?
Fox is also puzzled by this.
It's because, give the Hitchcock answer.
Because, Bab, there would be no movie.
That's correct.
But hey, there's one of the great twists in any movie. We talked about twists a few weeks ago with what are the best twist endings.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that from this movie because I saw it so long ago, so it wasn't like it was really that much of a gut shot. But when you first see this film, to know it's his own mother.
Yeah.
And just how horrible she can be.
Oh my gosh.
As well.
Yeah. She's a total nightmare. Wasn't she listed on the fourth best villain?
Not fourth, no. She was 21. So she was
21?
The 21.
Oh,
highest.
Wow.
Not a lot of women on the villain side, but she is one of the highest ranked ones.
She's great. And her performance is outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
One of the greatest performances we've seen so far, I think.
Mm-hmm. And hey, we saw it on Psycho. It's way subtler in that movie than this one that shows it flat out that there's some kind of incestuous relationship. And in the book, Raymond, when he's been brainwashed, is sleeping with his mother. Is
in bed with her. In the book, she had a romantic relationship with her own father. And because Raymond reminded her of her father, she would take advantage of him when he was under the influence of the Queen of Diamonds.
Right.
It's pretty insidious,
and this
man.
Is a pretty strong kiss on the lips, though, which was enough.
Oh, yeah. It's to give not us the subtle. Gist. Sinatra wanted Lucille Ball to play this. Mm-hmm. But Frankenheimer fought for Lansbury because he'd worked with her in All Fall Down and insisted that Sinatra watch that movie before he make his decision. She was only 3 years older than Lawrence Harvey, who's playing her son.
Mm-hmm.
She looks so much older than him, though. Like it's a,
not in a critical really, way. I'm sure you're not insulting
Angela Lansbury. I don't mean it. Looks, I mean, but... he looks very young is probably what I should say. She looks old for her age. He looks young for his age because it's convincing.
This is a Top 100 Project theme because we already had it with Cary Grant and Jesse Royce Landis in North by Northwest. She had something like 8 years on Cary Grant, but definitely looks a lot older. Maybe not
Shane
quite his
as
mother.
Well. Wasn't she far older than the two male
Gene
leads?
Arthur was way older than both guys, including the one she's married to, Van Heflin. And we're going to get it later in the 60s with The Graduate. Dustin Hoffman
is
not actually, of course, a late teen. He's in his late 20s, I think, at that point. And Anne Bancroft, who's barely older than he is, but she's supposed to be his mother's age.
Yeah.
So that is an ongoing theme. Lansbury's only AFI film is this one. She's still alive. She's not working as much as she used to. She does voiceover type work, including, of course, in Beauty and the Beast way back when in 1991.
Oh, yeah.
She's also known for Gaslight, which I think might have been her debut or one of her first films anyway, and The Picture of Dorian Gray. And then, of course, when she did Murder, She Wrote on TV, that would be her most famous performance.
Sure.
Although this is, what a different performance. I don't know if she played a lot of villains. I don't know a whole lot about Angela Lansbury, but wow, what a... change of pace it was from... I guess maybe she had played villains earlier on. I remember some of those characters were at least darker than Murder, She Wrote, Beauty and the Beast, that kind of stuff. You just said Sinatra. We've not even mentioned him more than in passing after all this time. Let's talk about the star of the film in what is easily the better of his two performances. From Into Eternity, he's a very fine supporting performance in that movie.
Yeah.
He's with so many big stars, Clift and Lancaster, and he deserved the praise and the credit he got for that film, including the Oscar. But I think he's way better in this film, way more effective in this film.
It's a harder role.
And so believable.
More complex, yeah.
So he'd been in From Here to Eternity. It's the last time we're going to see him now with these two AFI films. He also is known for Man with the Golden Arm, Guys and Dolls, Ocean's 11, and so many other great films.
And for just being Frank freaking Sinatra.
Yeah, I don't think we really talked about his singing career, which is probably even more famous than his acting career.
I know, it doesn't even really need to be mentioned.
No,
everybody knows
this
who
is
he
the
is,
film project, not the Top 100 Songs project. But you said it earlier that he had to be convinced to cast Angela Lansbury rather than Lucille Ball. He had a lot of influence for an actor. We're seeing this so much more now with actors literally being producers.
Yeah.
Or at least having unofficial producing credit.
It was his production company that made this film, right?
Oh, I did not know. I didn't know that part.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, well, there you go. I should have done my research better than I did, I guess. But he had the swing and the stroke in Hollywood to pull the movie from theaters after his friend JFK was gunned down. As I said, in a somewhat similar kind of theme with this one. People would say that it was the communists that did it at the time, too. I don't believe the communists killed JFK. Wow, let's not get into that. We'll be here for 3 hours.
So he denied that, though. He denied that Kennedy's assassination was the reason that he took the film out
money,
of release.
Wasn't it?
He said it was just lack of public interest. And
oh, really?
He shelved it until 1988.
Yeah. I actually read that it was more about profit sharing, and he wasn't getting what he thought of it.
Yeah, so it could have been something
like... He was known to be a fiery Italian fellow, and basically said...
Such a nice way of putting it.
Screw you guys, the movie's going to be out altogether, which is a weird thing to do. I don't think you'd see somebody do that now. Because if you can make $10, why wouldn't you make $10? But speaking of his salary, it was nearly half the budget of this entire film.
Oh my gosh.
But he did pay for it, because in his brutal hand-to-hand combat fight, that karate-type fight he has with Henry Silva, which was ahead of its time, too. That was something that had
incidentally,
really been done in American
another
movies.
White guy playing a Chinese character.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, Shunjin. He was played by... What'd you
Henry Silva's his name.
Yeah, Henry Silva. He's Sicilian and Spanish.
I'd forgotten he's such a part of the movie early on. He's part of the platoon, but obviously he's one of the reasons they get captured in the first place.
Yep.
He's a part of the whole thing. So he's really throughout most of the story. He's gone for maybe the last 45 minutes of the movie, but he's a pretty important character for so much of this film and helps put it in motion for sure and keep it in motion because he's the houseboy. But anyway, in that fight that they have, Sinatra hurt his hand pretty badly and it apparently bothered him the rest of his career because in one of those scenes, they show him chopping a table and breaking it.
Yeah.
And I guess in one of the failed takes, I don't think it's that actual take. He
broke his hand.
Yeah.
Apparently he had to turn down a film role because of that injury.
I think it may have been Dirty Harry.
No way.
The one that made Eastwood an American
star. Wow.
What'd you think after I just said a few minutes ago that From Here to Eternity, as good as it was, pales in comparison to this?
I think it's just a different part. It's a better part. It's a more complex part. I like
both military roles, though.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. I like having seen his range. All the acting is better in this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
He probably grew up in the interim, you know.
Yeah, it's been almost 10 years.
Probably became a better actor. He nails it.
Yeah.
He's really committed, and it's hard. It's not a very flattering role to play because he's losing his mind through half of it. Mm-hmm. And he sells it without overkill. I thought he was great.
Interesting, too, that he's in two black and white movies in the AFI, and yet he's called Old Blue Eyes. So we don't get a chance to see him sparkling with those blue eyes. Although in neither role is he really the guy that you want to see his eyes looking all cool and Mr. Sweetheart, because he plays this tragic character in both movies in a way.
He's not really romantic lead in any way in either of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about his romantic lead in this movie. Yeah. His romantic co-star, I guess I should say. Now, there's the first question. Janet Leigh in this film, very interesting element of her. We're going to talk about Roger Ebert in a second. We've talked about him so often. He makes a great point about her. But before we get to that point, do you think that she was inserted in this movie and plays his romantic interest simply because they wanted a woman, other than Angela Lansbury, who plays this horrible villainous character? They wanted somebody just to play off of Sinatra for a few scenes, this big star coming up as Psycho.
But their romantic scenes aren't even very romantic.
Which maybe undercuts that point.
I think, no matter what Frankenheimer says, because he kind of denies it,
okay,
she's a communist agent. Mm-hmm. Of course, she's his handler.
That's what Roger Ebert points out. That even the dialogue they have when they first meet is weird.
Yeah, I was one of the Chinamen who laid the tracks on this railroad. Yeah. It makes no sense, and he doesn't respond to it. And he's acting like a basket case for the entire time. He won't look at her. He's sweating. There's nothing romantic about that scene.
He's supposed to be on vacation.
Yeah.
Now, we know he's going to New York to meet up with Raymond to figure out what's going on with him. But still, he's supposed to be having at least a pleasant train ride.
Oh yeah, he can't light a cigarette, she helps him. There's nothing attractive about him in this scene. There's no reason why she should instantly fall in love with him and subsequently dump her fiancé.
Instantly.
In the book, her fiancé is one of Marco's associates handling the Shaw case for Army Intelligence.
God, well, that makes so, it stronger.
Yeah, well, exactly. If she's an agent, what would she do while she's waiting for assignment? She would date somebody in Army Intelligence. Yeah. That's exactly what a spy would do.
Yeah, I don't know if it's blatantly obvious that that's what she is, but I think if you want to look into it, it's kind of like Blade Runner. We're going to talk about the movie and the project eventually. Mm-hmm. Harrison Ford wants to deny, maybe he doesn't so much now, but for so long he said, no, Deckard isn't a replicant. Sorry for those who've not seen Blade Runner yet. You must have, and if you haven't, then you shouldn't listen to this project. But Ridley Scott insists.
You have to have seen all 120
yes,
movies.
Yes, you should have.
Or at least, before you listen to any of our
things. Really famous sci-fi movies like Blade Runner. But Ridley Scott, I think always, but certainly now, makes it seem like he almost wants to insult somebody who doesn't agree that Deckard was a replicant. Well, same with this. If Janet Leigh's not a communist agent, why exactly is she in the film? And again, being weird, saying weird things.
So weird. If you didn't want her to be a communist agent, if you just wanted them to have a romantic connection, you would play that scene out completely differently or not at all. There's no way that's what was intended.
But you know what's compelling is that we agree on this and it's better for the story because, for one thing, the last scene he has is with her and he has that great moment where he turns away and Sinatra, I don't know if he ever cried on screen, certainly didn't do it very often. It's, oh, hell, hell. Because he's, of course, honoring Shaw, who gave his own life, killed his mother, and killed his stepfather, and then himself. And Sinatra's overcome by that. But it's almost like, okay, if the movie kept going another 5 or 10 minutes, is it going to be that she gives him whatever his keyword is, and then he's going to go off and do something terrible?
Yeah, he'll be the replacement for Shaw.
And who's he going to kill? Well, Janet Leigh, of course, was in Psycho, her only other AFI film, so now she's done, too, as is Tony Curtis, her ex-husband. We've seen them so much lately. They've been in 4 of our recent movies. He's been in 2, and she's been in 2. Unfortunately, we didn't do Touch of Evil, which certainly should have had a shot at making this list. That's a great film. She worked for 60 years, and as we said on Psycho, she worked with her own daughter a few times, Jamie Lee Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you notice her character's last name is Chaney?
Okay, but that can't possibly be intentional.
Well, of course not. But she also, much like someone we know from recent history with that last name, seems bent on destroying America. Well, I'm not bent on destroying anything. Just making more money for my friends. And also, her nickname is Rosie. So is that a play on Rosie the Riveter?
Maybe.
Maybe I'm stretching here.
It is strange. She has the name Eugenie, and they talk about her name for so long in that strange roundabout conversation. Yeah, it just makes it just
well. There's a lot of Americana in this film. That's why I brought that up. There's a lot of Americana type stuff, and they're playing off those cliches. We often see Lincoln imagery.
Always with the Islands.
They Johnny's have that dressed big as portrait. Lincoln. At that,
yeah, he dresses like Lincoln at the
costume party.
Yeah, and then there's the portrait of Lincoln, in which they are always showing both Senator Island and Lincoln in the same image, which is subversive. Lincoln is this beloved American figure. Mm-hmm. This movie goes there.
I like both ends of that, though. If you had never seen the movie and you didn't know how it ended, then the characters in the film are suggesting this is the next Lincoln. We, of course, know that he's not, but that's what they want to believe. But then when you know the twist, it's that he gets murdered by somebody.
In a theater, no less.
In that public setting.
Yeah, yeah, no.
In a theater-type situation. Yeah. It may be Madison Square Garden, but it's not a hockey game. It is a political convention.
He gets shot in the head, too, I believe, And every time you see Senator Jordan, there's eagles everywhere. Like, just so American. So very American.
And then the way that he is killed, John MacGyver plays him. We're going to see him in Midnight Cowboy in a much different role later on. He also was in Breakfast at Tiffany's. When he's shot through the milk, then you get that, again, a double entendre type thing. One is you've got the pure white liquid.
American drink.
But also a way of showing gushing blood without showing blood.
It is such a beautiful scene because he trusts Shaw so much. And he's so shocked, even as the bullet goes through him, he's like, why? How could... But that, like, he's just...
Didn't you point out that it was reminiscent of when he shoots a kid in the brainwashing scene?
Yeah, the two murders that take place in the brainwashing theater, that was very similar, where there was just that absolute trust.
Mm-hmm. Raymond couldn't possibly shoot and kill me or strangle
even,
me.
Yeah, even as he's wrapping the thing around the kid's neck.
No, just let him do it. It's okay.
Oh, all right. Okay, like, just absolute trust. Mm-hmm.
Well, we talked so much about Shane, how that got me emotional. This movie didn't quite go there, but I think I gasped when he shot his father-in-law, his brand new father-in-law, as it turns out, and his wife. Even though I've seen the movie 3 or 4 times, because it's just so cold and cynical. What they do in this movie, the characters do, and I guess what the filmmakers do in this movie, are some of the worst things that happen to any AFI character. He kills people he loves, he kills fellow soldiers, he betrays his country, has no free will, and is manipulated constantly and sexually abused by his own mother.
It's an incredibly misanthropic movie. All the best characters in this film are either killed or practically destroyed by madness and possibly compromised, and the evil characters are the ones running the world.
And they probably win in the end because, as we said, if Janet Leigh's an agent, then this isn't over.
Even their version of winning, their happy ending, at the point that that film gets to, it's probably the happiest possible outcome. And you have Shaw dressed as a religious authority, wearing his Medal of Valor, murders his mother and stepfather before rather abruptly turning the gun on himself. That was the part where I gasped.
Yeah, you did.
And like audibly, you heard me.
You've seen the movie before. This is not your first time.
No, I don't think I had remembered exactly how it ended. Mm-hmm. I remembered a few details, but I couldn't remember how it ended, even though that's the most logical conclusion.
Yeah.
But it's done with such sharpness. It's vicious the way it's done. There's no swell of music. There's no, like, final confession. There's no gauzy shot of tears rolling down his face as he makes his final confession and explains why he has to end his life. He doesn't even really think about it. He knows what he has to do, and he just turns the gun right in front of Marco, shoots himself in the head.
Mm-hmm. And if they had had... I don't want to say the guts, because I showed it earlier, so that's once is enough. But his brain splattering all over the window behind him. We'd seen the brain splatter on the poster earlier. Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunately what Ben has to witness, is this kid he's come to care about, who earlier in the day had deprogrammed with the 52 Queens of Diamonds. All right, let's talk about that scene. The technical parts of this movie, some of them were happy accidents. And Robert Altman often said, the best things in movies are happy accidents. That may not be quite true to say that. But in this movie, there are two notable things that were. One is in the scene where Sinatra is deprogramming Raymond with all those cards. He's out of focus.
Yes.
Every time they cut to him, well, I don't know if it's the whole scene, but plenty of that scene is out of focus. Now, what happened was the focus operator just messed up. But Sinatra is always best on the first, maybe the second take. So I don't know if Sinatra said, I'm not going to do it again. But he wouldn't have been as good later on because he just never was. Apparently he was one of those guys that got it and they got worse as he went along. But they went with it because people said, what a great idea! Because it's Lawrence Harvey's perspective, which it isn't actually, because it's a camera that's over Lawrence Harvey's shoulder and quite a ways off the left of his shoulder, if you really think about it. But fine, we'll play in the notion that he sees the distorted version of this guy sitting right in front of him.
Yeah. I read that it was a rehearsal take.
Oh.
It wasn't even meant to be the take, and that's part of the reason why it was out of focus.
The other happy accident came in the brainwashing scenes. The way that the camera circles around, and it wasn't supposed to go quite like that, but Sinatra wanted to see how that was turning out, so Frankenheimer rushed a cut to him, and they realized this can really work, this interspersing of the garden party thing with either white women, or depending on the person's perspective, black women.
Yeah, I love that.
That was a great touch.
What a great detail.
And then, of course, the actual communist, I think all men, pretty sure it's all men, and, of course, with Kai D leading the charge there. But that great touch of it being whenever the women are on camera, they're talking about flowers, and then the men are talking about communism and brainwashing and all that stuff. But then there are times, actually, when it bleeds over, and a woman will say something that one of the communists would be saying.
I love those scenes. So when it's Captain Melvin, who's black, recalling the brainwashing scene, all the garden ladies are black women. When it's Marco, we're calling all the garden ladies are white women. It's such a great detail, but apparently this film was somewhat controversial because they cast black actors in non-servile roles without comment. It wasn't like the whole movie was about how there was a black psychiatrist. They just had a psychiatrist in the film and they cast a black guy and nobody even mentions it. Nobody treated that like it was something worth addressing. And Captain Melvin, too. Nobody brings up the fact that he's black, even though they clearly make a point to remind you that he's different in this way, but everybody seems to treat him the same as everybody else, and they never call attention to that. And I found this article in Variety. They wrote a whole article about how this was progress. They called it the Negro Prestige Role.
And that's a bit debatable. It's not like he's the
lead. I know. And I will mention this too. That psychiatrist, a black psychiatrist, which you remember, has a whole scene where he kind of explains what's going on. He was never credited. Even in the article that I read, they credited James Edwards as playing him when James Edwards played Sergeant Melvin.
Oh.
Yeah. Like they mixed up their credits because they were like, oh, well, you know. But I thought that was pretty interesting. So Axelrod.
Yeah, he's the guy who wrote the screenplay, George Axelrod.
George Axelrod, that's right. He also was a producer. Mm-hmm. I love this story. He became a producer on this project after working with Billy Wilder on Seven Year Itch, where he was advised by Wilder to stop complaining or get in the film business full time.
I guess he did that.
Yeah, because I guess he didn't like what was happening to his script. So when he was asked if he was worried that these appearances of black actors in unexpected places would jar the audience's attention, his reply was, if it does, then there's something wrong with the patron. Audiences are a lot more hip than many film people give them credit for. And
especially as the 60s are wearing on, because we're going to see more films with this type of thing, or we'll just get past it. Two movies in 67 deal with it directly. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and In the Heat of the Night are very racial.
But they're addressing that that's the main theme of the film, whereas it was unusual to see a black actor play a doctor.
And it's not a big deal. Well, that's great. Well, George Axelrod did write, as you said, The Seven-Year Itch and Bus Stop and Breakfast at Tiffany's. He adapted from the book by Truman Capote. And he was also a producer, like you said. We haven't seen a ton of writers who were also producers on their films, or at least a producer with other people. John Frankenheimer produced it, the director, and Howard Koch. Koch is a guy who produced Airplane, The Odd Couple, and lots of Oscar telecasts. So he had more of a comedy background, I guess, than a serious one. But then, as I said, this movie does have some funny moments, including Melvin waking up screaming and that having that horrible dream, and his wife asking, do you really like Raymond Shaw, don't you? The kindest, bravest, warmest one. Yeah. Because when Sinatra says it, it's more matter-of-fact. He does it in his Sinatra style. He's so excellently matter-of-fact in this movie. But that guy does it too much over the top. It works.
It's just enough.
But it's funny.
Yeah,
at the same time. So that's the producer. The director is John Frankenheimer, and his only AFI film. A lot of guys who worked on this film, a lot of people, I should say, never got back on the AFI list again. Frankenheimer is known for a ton of movies. He was a journeyman guy, but did some fine films like Birdman of Alcatraz, 7 Days in May. He worked with Burt Lancaster a lot. I mentioned Seconds with Rock Hudson way back when we did Giant, and that's one of Rock Hudson's best works. And French Connection Part 2 with a harrowing scene of drug use by Gene Hackman's character. And Frankenheimer, like Robert Altman, and like Billy Friedkin, was known for live television, also Sidney Lumet.
Yeah, yeah.
These guys broke in that way. Yeah. And we see a lot of that. We see the scene where Eisland's going on about how, oh, there are 217 communists at the State Department. And he's standing, actually on camera, but you have TV monitors in the foreground with the roll bar, unfortunately. But that also gives it kind of a verisimilitude, I guess you could say, where you see him on the TVs of our shot and the camera itself within the film. That wasn't really done that much. We didn't really see a lot of TV within it. But it makes sense. The 60s was starting to become the TV generation. JFK famously won a debate against Nixon, for those who watched it. But if you heard it on the radio, then they say Nixon won the debate. Mm-hmm. But TV's becoming a major part of people's lives and within movies now.
And the real star of that shot is Angela Lansbury watching the TV. Like, not watching her husband, who's practically right beside her, like just feet away. She's watching the TV because she knows what really matters is how he looks on TV. And her performance, her very quiet performance in that shot of absolute rapt attention and tension in herself, that shot is beautiful. It really stands out. Like everything else in this movie, it's just so full of energy. It's like it's electrically charged.
And there's so much to look at. There's Lansbury. There's the TV version of Eisland. There's the actual Eisland in the background of that shot. And I think Sinatra on the far right is also in that shot. So there's so much to look at. Your eyes have to be moving all
over
the place.
And it's busy. There's so many people and the cameras and those flash bulbs. Yeah,
and as you said, she's the ultimate puppet master over her husband, over her son, and over, almost at least, over America itself.
Oh, yeah, over the public. Yeah.
So Frankenheimer's technical skills worked well with what is kind of a sci-fi premise in a way. Brainwashing, like you said, making it happen in a couple of days, which does seem kind of illogical. But he used long takes. And we do see that way more in the old films. We've mentioned this in the podcast before, that longer takes were more the style. Woody Allen, when we get to Annie Hall, I'm sure there's plenty of those, because he's known for letting a movie just play out and let a whole scene play out, almost like it's a theater-type situation. Well, Frankenheimer used those kind of long takes, too, the documentary style.
Mm-hmm.
He did things like have the camera in a car as it pulls up. And politically, Frankenheimer wanted to take shots at the far right and the far left.
Yeah, that's probably one of the best things about this film, is it doesn't appear to take sides at all. It's really just trivializing the conflict between communism and capitalism altogether. It devotes very little time to the difference between the two philosophies, and the characters don't even seem that devoted to their own philosophies that they're fighting for, and it just paints it as a power struggle, like a competition to be won with the soldiers as pawns.
Right. And we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that based all of this on Richard Condon's book. It's him that started this in the first place. He also wrote Pritzi's Honor, which is a movie from 1985 with Jack Nicholson, directed by John Huston.
Oh.
We've been talking for quite a while now, and we haven't actually mentioned the co-lead in the film. And as much as Sinatra's fantastic, how do we not talk until now about Lawrence Harvey?
Yeah, good point.
Another guy in his only AFI film.
And he kills it. He knocks it out of the park.
He's fantastic. He was also in prestige-type films like Room at the Top, and he was in John Wayne's The Alamo, and Darling with Julie Christie the same year she did Dr. Zhivago. She won the Oscar that year for Darling. And Harvey didn't live too much longer after some of these fine performances because he died of stomach cancer at only 45 years old.
Oh, what a shame.
And I also did think one thing we'll be a little critical about right now is he does struggle to contain his English accent. He was born in Lithuania.
Oh, yeah. He sounds
you can hear
quite patrician.
Peeking through a little
bit
too often.
Yeah, yeah. I remember thinking in the first scene with his mother, why does she have a straight-up American accent and he has this kind of almost British accent?
You know, I'll play off on a few things for that. One is it could be yet another subversive thing. Let's cast an English guy to set him apart from the Sinatras, the Lansbury's, the Janet Lees of this film. But have him try to sound as American as he possibly can. Two, it could be he's supposed to be American. They thought he was the best guy for the role. But as good an actor as he might have been, he didn't quite master the accent. Which is not something to dwell upon too much anyway.
If we can forgive Tony Curtis's Brooklyn accent in Spartacus, we can forgive his British accent. I think at some point in the film I thought, oh, maybe he was sent away to a British boarding school.
And that's the third point I want to make. Yeah, you could have that be, that he was a rich kid. Obviously, Iceland and Mrs. Iceland. We never even learned her name, Angela Lansbury's character's first name. It's just Mrs. Iceland.
Yeah, she's mother.
But they're very wealthy people, clearly. And maybe the Shaws were wealthy before that. So yes, he could have gone away to school.
Yeah, but before we stop talking about him, I would be remiss if I didn't compliment the scene where he talks about how unlovable he is.
Yeah.
He admits how unlikable
that's
he is.
That's the key to the whole movie for him.
Oh my god, it is heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. He's drunk and he's just telling his kind of tale of woe, and it could have played out so corny, but it's so convincing. And even his panic at the end after he gets out of the lake and he's freezing cold and he doesn't know why he's there and he's confused and he's scared and he's vulnerable. So well played. It could have been ruined by an unqualified actor, but he absolutely
the scene where he jumps
it.
In the lake after the bartenders inadvertently told me. Yeah, because that is a funny scene and not really chortling out loud for 5 minutes or anything, but just the fact that he's so dedicated to this brainwash thing in his own head that he's going to literally do what this guy says in the winter in a scene where it really was wintry. I don't know if it was quite January or anything, but it's definitely very cold. And he does go into one of the lakes of Central Park. All right, I haven't asked you any trivia questions in this one, and you kind of took one earlier by saying he goes into MSG as a
priest,
right? But what award does he win when he comes back from the mission where he's now this phony hero?
Oh, I think I said, and I may have been wrong, I think I called it the Medal of Valor?
You're close. It's the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Okay.
And what, maybe there are more than one, I can't think of any others off the top of my head, but what future AFI movie will have another character winning this, and somebody absolutely incredulous that he does? They gave you the Congressional Medal of Honor.
I don't know.
Forrest Gump. Lieutenant Diane. Because Forrest saved his own people, which is what, of course, Raymond's phony story is, that he saved all these guys in battle, but of course he did nothing of the kind. Let's get back to the politics a little bit more before we wrap up. There's a line in A Beautiful Mind that Ed Harris's character says to Russell Crowe's character, McCarthy is an idiot, but unfortunately that doesn't make him wrong. So would the witch hunt, the actual witch hunt, have ended better and not been this whole about, have you no shame, sir, at the end, about McCarthy, if they'd had a better representative? Less of a buffoon, less of a jerk, less of a guy who's just going after people because he wants to just hurt reputations.
Yeah, for his own personal ambitions.
Which
or
we see now. Now you're a communist, same line, although it's the soft racism against Obama, and it's this kind of other stuff.
Or it's class warfare,
So the politics have really not changed too much, and that probably wasn't the beginning of dirty politics. In fact, it obviously wasn't the beginning of dirty politics, but it's one of the cheapest things that's ever existed in America, and it's done now in just a different form. Now, what about the two issues, the Cuban Missile Crisis had just happened when this movie came out, but do you think it maybe helped at the time? Do you think it hurt at the time?
God, that's a good question. I mean, Americans were really genuinely terrified. They probably didn't feel like making light of that situation. It was a harrowing and horrible thing that America went through, and Cuba for that matter. You know, because I wasn't there, I could never say.
It's funny how sometimes when tragic situations happen, like the Missile Crisis, like JFK getting killed, people sometimes run away from things that challenge them. Sometimes they run towards them.
Yeah.
But one of the things that happened after 9/11 was people wanted to see Independence Day, and they wanted to see Armageddon.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And they wanted to see the movies that were about horrible death and destruction and the ruining of either America or the world entire. But they wanted to see in the end, of course, that we all win, or at least America does.
Those movies are much more optimistic than Manchurian Candidate.
More people die, way more death and destruction, too.
Sure, but yes. It's a far more positive ending than Manchurian Candidate.
This is definitely one of the bleakest endings that the AFI has by any stretch of the imagination. Even Platoon, with as many people that die in that movie, and the movie's about a war that Oliver Stone, who was in the war, wrote, directed, he knew what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And yet even that movie has some uplift at the very end with Charlie Sheen's voiceover.
Hey, look, Manchurian Candidate, for all intents and purposes, has a happy ending.
Yeah, yeah, if you're going to believe that Janet Leigh is just a girlfriend and not an agent.
They don't press it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like Chinatown, where you're absolutely positive
for another those bleak who know ending. The ending. Yes, yeah.
That's a bleak ending.
Yeah, that's true.
Whereas, I don't know, it's not really pressed the way...
A lesser filmmaker than Frank and I remember to cut to a shot of her, the look on her face that says, yeah, now I got him. He's all emotional about Shaw blowing his own head off.
Mm-hmm.
Now comes his mission. But yeah, I don't think they show her in close-up at all in that last scene. You know she's there. He's talking to her.
Yeah.
But the scene belongs to him. It's maybe 30 seconds to a minute long, and the movie's over.
What is she doing there anyway, when you think about it?
Well, they're supposed to be together romantically.
She's a communist. Speaking of that scene, you pointed out something amazing when we were watching the film, which is the whole film's about brainwashing, how brainwashing is this insidious evil. And then as the two soldiers are running to stop Shaw from assassinating presidential candidate, they have a very important job to do. But then what happens?
As soon as the national anthem comes on, they stand at attention and stop the rest of that
stuff. They can't stop themselves.
Because I've said this before, with no disrespect to soldiers, but are they the most brainwashed people on the planet?
Probably.
Just by the very nature of their job, they're brainwashed.
Yeah. It is kind of your job to act without thinking. So they act without thinking, even though they so desperately need to get to that room. Those seconds matter. But they can't not stop for the anthem and salute and just stand there and wait for it to be over before they continue with their mission. Great piece of filmmaking at the climax. The funniest part is that when it first happens, you're like, oh yeah, of course they have to stop for the anthem. You don't realize how absurd it is until you think about it, because they really do let it kind of play out for a while.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So, so, so smart.
And if people somehow haven't seen this movie yet and have listened to us anyway and have it destroyed for them, I don't know if we made it clear earlier that Raymond is supposed to be killing the actual presidential candidate.
Yes.
And Johnny is actually the vice presidential candidate.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that Mrs. Iceland says earlier, that there's been a speech that's been worked on in Russia for 4 years on and off.
Yeah.
I want to hear what that speech is. I want to hear that thing.
I know.
How good is that speech? It's the greatest speech I've ever heard. That she says
to him. We never get to hear it.
Yeah, they kind of cheat us on that one. But she also has other great quotes. This movie has no top 100 quotes, but it's got some really good ones. Maybe because they're so long and because they are so bleak. Mrs. Iceland says things like, they'll sweep in the White House with powers that will make martial law seem like anarchy.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, we're closer to now in 2014 in America than ever before, unfortunately, in many ways. Because there's so much firepower out there with both the good guys and the bad guys. And that, of course, is subjective too. Who are the good guys and bad guys? And there's also the line that Kai D has earlier, the brainwasher, where he says, the uniquely American symptoms of guilt and fear. Because when you brainwash somebody, they don't know they did this. I mean, God, they make Raymond kill his own wife, who he truly loves in every way, because she's a witness to this murder he's committed.
It's the only person who loves him, you could argue. Well, his father-in-law probably loves him too, but Jocelyn is the one who saves him from that unbearable loneliness.
Yeah. He would have been happy if he'd been with her. He had a pretty good job. Very good job, actually, which he also got because he killed the boss, but didn't know he did it.
Yeah.
He has no idea that he did it. The things they make this poor guy do. Also, one of the other themes that we had in a previous AFI film, we're going to have another ones, or movies that will clearly have this element. The war films of Platoon and Saving Private Ryan, horrendous PTSD. Best Years of Our Lives is all about post-traumatic stress disorder. And this movie certainly got it, too.
Yeah, yeah.
In space, with their dreams, Marco and Melvin can't sleep. And incidentally, the story that's been planted in their head about what's really gone on, that they were at this garden party and that Raymond was a hero and all this crap they've been fed, kind of falls apart pretty easily. Maybe because they were rushed, but the brainwashers don't really plan in there very well. These guys pull this apart pretty quickly, both Marco and Melvin. They're really the only two people that are ever actually objecting to this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because Shaw doesn't know anything's really truly wrong with him.
No, that's true. He doesn't suspect the way that they do.
And these two guys aren't, well, we really don't see Melvin again since that letter to Shaw, and he's pretty much out of the film at that point. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much just Marco trying to do something about this, and people don't truly believe him either, including his own girlfriend, who is probably the enemy. As we get closer to a wrap here, the theme that Mrs. Iceland's own son is used as the trigger man, as the killer, and that she wants to make the communists pay for that, even though she's a communist herself, may not entirely hold up if you really think about it. It's the Hitchcock thing about being at the refrigerator and thinking about that later, and doesn't really entirely hold up. But it just shows how vengeful she is, and also shows how smart they are to really get her in deep. If they'd pick Marco or Melvin or one of the other guys to be the killer, maybe she turns on them somehow. I know she's saying to her own son that she will turn on them, but they maybe don't believe that because they've used her own son.
Maybe she just wouldn't be as invested in him succeeding in his mission and getting away scot-free as well.
Except when it's her own son.
Yeah.
One thing we didn't talk about yet is the reception this film got. So currently on Rotten Tomatoes, 98% of critics. Very strong number there. 91% of audiences. 9% of those people are wrong. The remake, 2004, Denzel Washington, Meryl Streep. One of her worst over-the-top bad performances she ever gave.
Oh, really?
And Leah Schreiber, who plays the Raymond Shaw character, gets 81% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is pretty good, and only 63% from audiences. I wrote a review of that film. I didn't like it, partly because I loved the original so much, and they don't even have the solitaire sequences in that film. They show it very briefly in the early part of the film where somebody's just playing solitaire. I think Shaw is playing solitaire. Someone is. In the background of a scene, fine, make your own movie, but how do you not include one of the most famous parts of this movie?
I know.
And within that, the Queen of Diamonds imagery, including Josie, Raymond's future wife, wearing the giant card, which is, again, a sort of comical touch that she's wearing this card. Has no idea it means anything.
Yeah.
But not only is it a playing card, but it's twice the size of her.
Yeah.
Now, as far as the critics go, we talked about Roger Ebert loving this movie and making that point about Janet Leigh's character. Pauline Kael, who we haven't really quoted a ton on this project, but she called this movie the most sophisticated political satire ever made in Hollywood.
She was right. I agree with Pauline Kael.
Satire, though. We're going to get
it
into...
It is a satire. Well, I would say it's a satire.
Strange Love is very much satirical, too.
It's much a more funnier overt satire. Kind of way. Yeah, yeah.
Because actually, those characters are beyond buffoonish. Except for Iceland in this movie. Nobody's buffoonish. All right, so quickly just get into some of the tech people. Lionel Lyndon shot the movie he did Going My Way and Around the World in 80 Days. So he did some Best Picture winners. But his only AFI film is this one. Ferris Webster, 43 years in the business. Did Magnificent Seven, Great Escape, and The Outlaw, Josie Wales. He cut all those and this one too, and he was nominated for the Oscar but didn't win. Maybe should have. The music's David Amram, who's 83 years old and still alive, and he did Splendor in the Grass. We talked about that when we talked about West Side Story last week. And the sets are by Richard Silbert, who won two Oscars, did four AFI films, including Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, The Graduate, and Chinatown. He also did sets for Rosemary's Baby, Shampoo, Reds, and Carlito's Way. Wow, what a filmography. Manchurian Candidate has plenty of influence, I'm sure, but two things I definitely want to mention in particular. The remake we just talked about, which I don't think succeeds nearly as well, does have a pretty decent ending, though. And Homeland, where a soldier is turned on his own country against his will.
Definitely. I think also it's one of those things that you see homaged in a lot of TV shows. I know Simpsons did this with Sideshow Bob and Bart, and it's that specific storyline of somebody being brainwashed to respond to one specific phrase. I feel like it's something I've seen over and over done in TV. It's definitely remained in the public consciousness, whether people realize that this was the source or not, because this is one of those movies not a lot of people have seen.
Yeah, unfortunately.
When I just kind of do my informal poll, people don't know what I'm talking about. A lot of people have never even heard of it, which is such a crime!
A black and white movie from 1962 with as big a star as Sinatra was, the rest of the cast, even Janet Leigh, is probably not that well known by modern audiences. Maybe Sinatra's not that well known either. And a director that's not exactly in the zeitgeist. Maybe those issues all held it back from being as well-known as West Side Story and Sound of Music and ever the films from the 60s that are big, splashy Technicolor films.
Well, if the Top 100 would just go ahead and put it back on the list. Just to start.
Part 3, they really should. Okay, the awards sections. Not that much, but there's a few good ones here. Lansbury is nominated for Supporting Actress, but didn't win. And the editing by Ferris Webster. And that's it.
Yeah, the editing was exceptional, I will say. I'm very glad it got recognized because this is actually an innovatively cut film.
The movie's a little over 2 hours long, but it did not feel even close to that
long.
No,
the pacing is absolutely phenomenal. This is a great example of a well-cut film.
Yeah. The film made the National Film Registry in 1994, 5 years in. Probably should have been 89, but okay, fine. Mrs. Iceland, as we said, was 21st on the Heroes and Villains list of The Dark Side, and the movie was 17th on the Top 100 Thrills list. At least that's a pretty good ranking, because it's a great thriller, which, if you've never seen before, unfortunately, we've ruined the entire movie for you at this point, but you probably wouldn't know where it's going. And even Raymond going into MSG at the end, he looks robotic, like he would have if he actually still
you
was
You don't know
programmed.
What he's going to do. They play it really well.
And they play it that way because, of course, they have to, so we don't know what's going on, but also because he's going up there because he knows he's going to kill his own stepfather and his mother and probably knows he's going to kill himself. So he would go in there robotically.
Mm-hmm.
Let me get this mission done. Again, he's a soldier, and I don't want to disrespect soldiers, but when they have a mission, they can be pretty straight-ahead people and pretty emotionless because that's what they're trained to do.
I don't think that's disrespect. I think it's a hard job.
Something I couldn't do.
No, no kidding.
All right, so closing thoughts on a great film that was knocked off the list.
This is like one of those rare miracles where every element delivers and fits perfectly. It's brilliant. It's daring. It raised the standard for satire. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's like a powder keg with a lit fuse for 2 hours. You were just absolutely on the edge of your seat. And you don't have to be a classic film fan to enjoy it. It is aged so well. Oh my gosh. I love this movie so much, you guys.
A pox on AFI voted for knocking it off the list. 67th was a pretty fair ranking. There's nothing wrong with that. Maybe a little higher would have been great. You think top 10.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'd put it that high.
I had a guess when you told me that it got knocked off the list. And my guess is that because the second list is 2007, I bet a lot of those voters had just watched the remake.
Could be.
And probably had watched the remake more recently than they had seen the original. And they were like, I don't know, that movie wasn't so great. But it's because they hadn't seen the original since they seen the remake.
And a post 9/11 effect, maybe they didn't want to
get behind a movie like this. Yeah, it's certainly not a patriotic film, so,
All right, that was a fantastic film, The Manchurian Candidate. And if you haven't seen it, of course, we've ruined it for you at this point.
It's still worth watching.
But see it for the first time or see it again, because it's held up so well. Up next on the Top 100 Project is the epitome of big screen epics, and what a change of pace this is. David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, I loved Bridge on the River Kwai, so I am curious about this one.
Because you have not seen it, right?
I've never seen it. I'm a little trepidatious, because how long is it? 3.5 hours?
At least that long, yeah.
I'll do like stretch first.
It's going to be a bladder tester for sure.
Yeah.
The coming attractions trivia for Lawrence of Arabia. There are three movies that share the following achievements. Now get ready. They made both of AFI's top 100 lists, along with the top 100 cheers, the top 25 music scores, the top 10 epics. They won Best Picture and are in the National Film Registry. What are these three motion pictures?
That's a great question.
And you know one of them.
Yeah.
That's why would I bring it up if it weren't for Lawrence of Arabia?
Sure, sure. That's a great question. For the answer to that, please tune in next week to our Lawrence of Arabia podcast. If you'd like more trivia and lots of other fun stuff from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find our podcast on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. We'd love to hear what you think of The Manchurian Candidate. Perhaps you disagree with us, or talk to us about any other films that we do. Please send us an email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And one more time, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Yeah, go get your coffee, your fresh grounds. Get it today, at least if you're Canadian.
Get them sent to you, as a matter of fact. You don't even have to leave the house.
Right, so you can sit and watch Manchurian Candidate even longer.
While someone's fetching you fresh roasted coffee.
And we've had fake sponsors before. We like to think they were kind of funny. But this is real, people.
We aren't kidding. They have delicious coffee. So now that we're done, perhaps you'd like to pass the time by playing some solitaire, Ryan.
You are the kindest, warmest, bravest, most wonderful human being I've ever known in my life.
And cut.